I thought that it would be nice for me to take a few questions tonight, but then just as we were chanting, something else occurred to me that I think has been kind of working on me all day, but I didn't understand it until it just made itself clear. So we'll see what happens. On CBC this morning, I heard part of a show. I don't even really know what show it was. But Bill McKibben was talking. And he said, he's an environmentalist. The show seemed to be something about the weather or the environment or something like that. And he said something that I had never really understood in context before. He said that until very recently, human beings have always been subject to the effects of the weather. That the weather and the environment in many ways shaped human life. It was hot, it was cold, it was freezing, it was an ice age. I mean, all the obvious things that have taken place. And for the first time in history, in the last very little while, the weather and the environment is subject to the actions of human beings. And that this has never happened before, that human beings have had such an effect on the environment of the entire globe. Just 300 years ago, that wasn't true. 200 years ago, that wasn't true. So it's very, very recent. And for millions of years, the environment has been what it's in, and for however what it's been, and however long human beings, or any beings that we can even relate to as human beings, have existed, the environment has shaped our lives. So recently, we've turned history over. We've turned the whole pattern, the whole dynamic over, and that in fact, in a very short amount of time since, and I missed this date, but it's not long ago, there's 40% more acid in the oceans than there was then. Now, there's 40% more acid in the oceans now than there was then, and then is within my lifetime. 40% more acid. Do you know what would happen if somebody suddenly poured 40% more acid in your body? Imagine. Think about that. Or if I had a test tube and suddenly of water and I added 40% acid, and it's mind-boggling. It's really mind-boggling. And that's just one example of how we've affected the environment. Apparently, sometime long ago, and again, I didn't get the date, this term was used. It used to be called the Holocene era. And then this term became known as the Anthropocene. Scene means new. And anthropod is, you know, so human, person. So basically it's the person scene. We're the major player. For the first time ever, we're the major player. Now, we hear this so much that I think we don't even hear it anymore. Most people say, oh yeah, we're really affecting the environment. It's almost like saying nothing, because it's just in the news all the time. But it doesn't really touch us. We don't really know the truth of that. And I think what was working on me all day long, without realizing it until just before the end of that chant, was the idea that while it's true that we as a species are affecting the environment in the major ways that we are, and none of them are good. There's a statement of fact. It's not like we're helping at all. Can anybody here think of one way, in which we are helping the environment? There must be one. There's 6.5 billion people. Is there any way
Maybe doing ourselves in a little quicker.
Maybe dying sooner. Yeah, possible. I mean, think about it. Isn't that shocking to you? Not one way. Everything that we're doing to help the environment is to undo what we've done to harm the environment. I mean, that's an astounding statement. We're in a relationship with the environment. And we are the abuser. If you were in a relationship with somebody and they did nothing but harm you, you would understand what we're really doing. This is truly a remarkable thing to realize in a full way. So what I think was working on me was to take that knowledge from a place that we can't control. We can't control what everybody does, but bring it home to what we can control. And I want to switch what I'm saying now from the weather and the environment to any environment that we find ourselves in. And say, do you know the effect that you yourself have on every single environment that you are in? We're in a very funny place. We are made to feel powerless. And yet, even feeling powerless affects the environment that we are in. Does that make sense to you? Someone who feels powerless in his life or in her life affects every interaction that they have with that feeling of powerlessness. For example, so no matter what we are in any given moment, we are having an effect on our immediate environment, our home environment, our physical environment, let's say on the land that we live on. Of course, that's obvious. Every relationship we have, what it's like to stand in line at the market, what it's like to be a neighbor or have a neighbor. Think of it, every single environment. By environment, I mean interaction at this point, because everything is context. If we begin to truly understand how powerful we are in all these micro environments, we can really find a way for us to practice so meaningfully, so beautifully, so powerfully, so helpfully, so generously, so importantly, so significantly, so humanely. We can actually do something that we can't do in the large scale, but we can really do it in every single micro environment in which we find ourselves. Every interaction is part of what I'm talking about when I say environment. But we can't do it unless we're in touch with the fact that we can do it. We have to remember, we have to wake up to the fact that we actually are having an effect. And the effect we have, we can have, doesn't have to be this constant destruction, abuse, and negativity that we're having on the, you know, on the climate, for example, on that environment as a whole. We can actually have almost entirely nothing but a beneficial effect. Nothing but a beneficial effect. The exact opposite of everything that we as a species are doing to the larger environment. There is always some way that we can bring benefit to the situation. Always. There's no situation in which we can't. If we remember that we have that capacity, and if we remember that actually that's what makes life good. So it's a matter of bringing that awareness. And at first, we have to choose to remember it because we forget. We have to choose. I'm going to remember this as much as I can today. Or I'm going to remember this as much as I can until 9 o'clock this morning. And see how many times you go to sleep before 9 o'clock and forget. And then extend it. Okay, 9:30 on Tuesday. 10 o'clock on Wednesday. But really keep that in the forefront. And what's happening is that that sort of intention hooks up with our bodhisattva vow. Mm-hmm. That's the connection right there. That's our bodhisattva vow. Finding a way in daily practical life, not in some kind of like fantasy of, you know, I'm going to save all beings by some magic that I don't really understand. But I'm going to live in a way that is as completely beneficial as possible. So that living makes sense. Because living the way we're living in relationship to the environment as a species, you know what that's called. It's suicide. That doesn't make sense. We can do the opposite in all the micro-environments in which we find ourselves. So I'm going to ask you to seek a way to remember tomorrow, starting tomorrow. Seek a way. Remember that this is our way. This is important. This is the practice of the Buddhist teachings. This is the practice of oneness. This is the practice of interdependence. Because of interdependence, when we work in the way that I'm talking about, it spreads fast. It goes really fast. The effect is enormous, big. It really goes far. Instead of 40% acid, add 40% kindness, 40% thoughtfulness, 40% awareness that the other person actually is right in front of you. And they're actually saying something to you that they need to have heard. I mean, it sounds almost silly, but the truth is that we go so deaf, dumb, and blind about what our life really is that I think we do need these kinds of reminders. I received an email today from a very wonderful man named Michael Stone. He's a teacher, a yoga teacher, and a Buddhist teacher. And apparently, I didn't remember it, but he had invited me to lead a literary tour or something, I'm not sure what it's called, literary journey or something in Japan this coming spring, going to important Buddhist and literary sites in Japan. And then the disaster of Fukushima happened. And I wrote to him and I told him I can't do it. There's no way I can bring sort of North American tourists to go wander around Japan when the people are suffering as much as they are. The privilege would kill me. And apparently I wrote something in the letter to him that he's writing an article for Shambhala Sun, so he wrote this morning to say I'd like to quote this thing you wrote in the letter. And I don't remember the quote, but the essence of it was that Japan was sacrificed through nuclear war. And now, just 75 years later, through another stupendous act of ignorance, it has been sacrificed to nuclear peace. Now we see what nuclear peace really looks like as opposed to some drawing board dream. You know, wonderful, endless energy, it's clean energy, or, you know, something like that. When I read it this morning, I thought, we really need to see far down the road what our actions are doing. Far, far, far down the road. We really need to see when someone proposes this wonderful pipe dream of nuclear energy, for example, what that actually will be. Actually will be. Do you know that Kaz told me that one of the reasons that the disaster happened at Fukushima the way it did is that they had backup systems, but they were all in the same place, which was affected by the quake. So they had backup systems right next to where they had their systems. And they had them all together. So there was no backup system. It made no sense. They couldn't, an engineer couldn't say, oh, wait a minute, if this is in trouble, this will be in trouble. They couldn't see that far. So, but had they had them somewhere else, maybe, there might have been some kind of quick action that could have been taken. But they didn't. And it was right there, in front of the eyes of the designers and engineers, all of whom said, yeah, this is a great idea. It'll save space. We should listen to that a little bit as a metaphor for how we behave. What are we missing? How could we see a little further? How could we predict, if I do this this way, this might happen? If I do this this way, this might happen. And take our best guess at that point, knowing that, our goal, is to bring benefit to every single thing that our activities affect. So I ask you to please... don't forget this. Now please try to remember that you are always in a context or a contextual environment that you have the power to affect in positive or negative ways. This sangha began after 9/11. That's almost exactly 10 years ago this week. And it began as part of my response to what happened on September 11th, where I felt that I couldn't wait any longer to see if anybody would be interested in practicing Zen here. That's why I put the signs up, and that's how this whole thing got started. The only thing I could think to do after 9/11 was to teach Zen. And I wasn't doing it because I was sort of taking my time finding out where I was in my new home. And I thought, emergency. I have no more time. I don't have another second. Emergency. Signs went up. People showed up. That's the root of the Sangha. We started because of 9/11. We would have started anyway at some point. But, you know, I would have been... take my time, be lazy, kind of say, oh, I can start next month, it's no problem, it's okay. They'd never practice Zen anyway, so they won't miss it for 2 months. You know, some kind of fantasy. Of course, on September 10th, it was also an emergency situation. It took 9/11 to make me realize how stupid I was. What are you doing? You have this treasure, you should give it to people. So, in a way, our sangha began because I realized how stupid I am. I mean it. I felt that. I was ashamed. When I thought, what can I do? And I thought, I have to teach Zen here. And I felt ashamed that I had not done it before. You know, that I was relaxing, taking it easy, checking it out. So, you know, we are in an emergency situation every day. And we don't have to be depressed, and we don't have to feel bad, we don't have to feel ashamed, we don't have to feel guilty, we don't have to feel any of those things. All we have to do is to seek to bring benefit to every environment that we affect as much as possible. And I ask you to please continue. I know that you're doing it as much as you can, but please do it more. And that's what our life requires. Mm-hmm.